Welcome to the Jig Is Up podcast with your hosts, Darcy and Jason. The Jig Is Up is recorded on the traditional lands of the Blackfoot Confederacy, as well as the lands of Treaty Six Nations. We aim to bring you new perspectives and open up conversations about Métis politics, culture, and current events, as well as stories that affect Indigenous from all over. If you like the show, or you don't, or if you want to send us suggestions for guests or topics to discuss on the show, feel free to email us at metispodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on all of the social media at Métis Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. I'm Jason, and with me today is Seb Millett. How are you doing today, Seb?
I'm doing great, despite confinement and the current COVID crisis that affects everyone on this planet. We're doing not bad at all. We're lucky.
Yeah, we're fairly lucky in Canada where everyone seems to have some space, a little bit of a backyard they can go to. Hopefully the weather is shaping up for people. We're not all confined too much in the house.
Well, hopefully, you know, this situation is not too hard on too many, but we are well aware of the dire situation in which many First Nations are facing, and the Inuit and Métis people as well, you know, be often of a distant community with already very little services, and in terms of food sovereignty, water, and everything else, you know, we already knew that the situation was bad in many places in this country. And now that we're facing this crisis, I think that we're getting to understand that we need one another more than ever, and that we need to pull up in solidarity and make sure that the most vulnerable among ourselves are helped. And help in very significant way, you know, in terms of not only the disease, but also let this be a lesson to us all. I would think that, you know, these remote communities, as well as First Nations, Métis and Inuit, as well as, in fact, all Canadians deserve the best services possible. And that we need to work together so that we can achieve this. And I just want to put a word out there before perhaps we start, for our first responders that are risking their lives out there. You know, it's a tough choices. Many of them have to separate from their families. We know people on the first lines. I mean, you know, they have to get away from their kids, get away from their loved one, their elders, in order to help, in order to support day after day. While we stay home, these people must go on the battle line every day. And it's a hard task. Myself, you know, I did just a little bit of service in that regard, being a veteran of the Royal 22nd Regiment. I was deployed during the big ice storm. I don't know if you remember that, Jason, but in a big ice storm occurred in Quebec around 1998, and that situation led to civilian, in need. They were in need of the military, and all the authorities were in need of the military to step in and to make sure that everyone was okay in terms of security, in terms of the housing, and all of that. So it's the second major crisis, at least from the perceptions of all Canadians, I would think, that we're facing that may involve the military at this point at large scale. Hopefully we're going to learn from this, and we're going to do better, so to speak.
Yeah, for sure. I think it really does highlight the inequities a lot of Indigenous communities face in chronic underfunding in so much of the services that go on there, and how much that needs to be addressed. Hopefully it comes more to light and stays in the mainstream media, and this will result in some positive action getting done, hopefully.
Right, absolutely. I'm just going to move perhaps in front of my house now, because I don't know, the line may be a little bit choppy. Do you hear me well?
I hear you really well, yeah.
Okay, cool. So I'm just going to go move in front of my house so that our conversation may not be so choppy on my end. So I apologize for the people tuning in with us. I'm just moving around the house now with the kids and all that. So it's adaptation for all of us, including the kids that must stay home now and not seeing their friends and all of this. And so, and hopefully you guys gonna, you know, recover well. I mean, we're hearing a lot about you guys in Alberta from the East Coast here. We know that your situation is pretty rough as well in terms of the economy and everything else. So we are hoping that that across this land, we may pull up in solidarity again and make sure that no one is left behind in terms of that crisis and in terms of its economy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, anyway, so yeah. We have you on the show because you've got a new book coming out in English now.
I do. I do. It's not only, well, yeah, it's a new book. It's an augmented version of our French Les Bois Brûlés de l'Outaouais, which is the bois brûlé. You know, the term refers to historical métis, and we can discuss a little bit more about this, but the bois brûlé of the Outaouais region or the Ottawa Valley. So next, right at the border of Quebec and Ontario, the Ottawa River there, there's a region with different rivers and system connecting, water system connecting to it. And so we did an examination of a community there around Maniwaki. So in the, you know, on the northern front of the Outaouais region on the Quebec side of it. So there's a community there that exists in terms of Métis. You know, they exist at least not in their historical form, but contemporary form. They exist at least since the 1960s. And in terms of their political battles to get recognitions. And so they're one of the oldest and most active community in Quebec. With the Abitibi community as well in Quebec, per the evidence that we've seen. And so we did an investigation about that community, you know, in terms of the historical evidence, in terms of the oral evidence as well. And we wrote a book in French called Les Bois Brûlés de l'Outaouais. And we also did an English version of that study, in which it's not just a translation in French, it's an augmented version, because both book were evaluated by independent community, committees. Apologize for my French accent. Sometimes it's getting rough after a few days of not speaking English. Apologize. So independent committees that evaluated those books by peers, and one, the French book, was published at Presse of l'Université Laval, and the English augmented version was published at UBC, so the press of the University of British Columbia. So we're pretty happy with this. We did this, Guillaume Marcotte, Michel Bouchard, and myself. We worked really hard into these books, and the English version, we're really proud of it. I mean, because we want to break that, you know, linguistic solitude across the country, and we want to bring this conversation to, you know, the nation as a whole, basically, and make sure that people do understand our arguments and not just what people say about our arguments, you know, like on social media and what happened with all this this violence and all this, you know, misunderstandings. I like to think in terms of Métis identities and the possibility that we can move forward to our clearer waters in regards to that. So we try to do our share in regards to that by making sure that both, you know, that the people can read it in English as well as in French. We're always doing an effort to try to put our work in both language so that people can get the best of these arguments. And the augmented version is an augmented version, especially in the case that reviewers from UBC Press did ask us to put a little bit more arguments there in terms of what's going on in social media and what's going on in terms of the rhetoric of race shifting. And, you know, I'm sure you heard about that, Jason, that a lot of people are accusing the Eastern Métis and, or, you know, Métis from everywhere else, then this notions of Red River Métis Nation, that they are, in fact, race shifters or ethnic frauds or mere opportunists and the like. So the editors, as well as the reviewers, ask us to be a little bit more kind of, you know, taking this conversation to the next level, so to speak. So that we did in English, and we're pretty happy with the result. I mean, we're trying our best to show that when you're studying historically the Métis, you're not seeing these easy accusations of race shiftings and these easy accusation of opportunisms, you know. And we're trying to show that with evidence and with historical evidence along the way, not only in terms of the region of the Ottawa region, but also in terms of the historical evidence that portray all Métis, you know. So basically, if you get to know that, for example, important figures such as Johnny Grant, for example, you know, well-known Métis Johnny Grant, in his memoirs, wrote plainly that at some point in his life, he considered himself Canadian. At other points in his life, he considered himself an Indian, and obviously as a Métis. And some could look at the life of Johnny Grant, a Western Métis, by the way, and say, well, this guy was a race shifter. You know, this guy was not clear about his identity, and so on. Just like many people are accused now today on Twitter or other social media in regards to their ancestor or their journey. Mm-hmm. And we, like, you know, the case of Johnny Grant, to take just one example, which we have explored as an example, because he's a Western Métis, show you that the Métis people are born out of cumulative identities. And this is not wrong. This is a good thing for many Métis, especially back in the day where the pragmatics of surviving and thriving, you know, it was seen as a great thing to use the possibilities of different identities in a cumulative way. That's not to say that you're not a Métis. It's to say that, you know, the possibility of shifting, like it is suggested, is not a hallmark of Métis falsity or fraud. The possibility of shifting identities was a tactics employed by Métis people out west, out east, out north, and out south, in order to survive colonialisms and racism, and in order to make sure that they could get the best out of everything, you know, including, you know, shady realities such as alcohol trafficking and fewer contraband. Of course, a lot of Métis could use historically speaking, these different identities in order to make sure that they got the best out of everything and every deal. Just as we know that out west, for example, we have Métis people that took treaty, and some of them who opted out of treaties and back and forth like that, you know, in order to get the best deal to survive for their families, considering themselves, you know, indigenous. That's the way in which people operate. So, you know, if you look at those facts and if you look at the real history of the Métis culture, then you realize that these accusations of race shifting are pretty, you know, are not accurate in terms of the situation which is going on now, you know. So people back then used to have different identities. People today have different identities. I'm just going to tell you an example. For example, you can be, you know, some Métis are proud to be Métis and also proud to be Quebecois or Canadians, or some of them also have like dual ancestry. You know, some Métis have dual ancestry. For example, they will be First Nations and Métis, you know, in their family. So what are you asking now of these people? You know, you're asking them to be like only proud of their Métis heritage, but not proud of their First Nations heritage if they have some, or Inuit heritage for that matter. I mean, you know, so this madness happening in universities today about, like, you know, establishing the purity of Métis people for some kind of genealogical arguments, or, you know, the fact that they belong or not to some ideas or concepts of a nation, it's not totally accurate. And we took this conversation very seriously in order to prove that it's not only wrong to suggest that the Métis people that had different identities were just fraud, but to make this argument today is no better, right? So, I mean, this is about the augmented part that I think that the public will like about the UBC version, is that we took that conversation, like I said, to the next level. And after that, we did produce the material and the evidence to show, in fact, that the Métis of the Outaouais do form a Métis population in its cultural aspects, as well as its historical aspects. So
what was it about that region that interested you most, that was the Métis community you wanted to focus on?
Well, you know, it has been a long journey with the Outaouais. I myself live in the Outaouais region, so this is close to home, right? I'm traveling routes and rivers that I'm seeing every day in terms of the history that we did in the archives and the documents. The research, we were always curious in terms of the research in line with what we did in Songs Upon the River. You know, we wrote a book, Songs Upon the River, that basically tried to map like the cultural emergence of Métis peoples across the continent, across North America, right? From the East Coast to the Oregon coast. And basically to show that there's a rhizomatic, it's like a multiplications of points of emergence, right? The Métis people being a fur trade people, like their nexus by which they emerged, the Métis, is through the fur trade, right? We get to understand this. And by emerging through the fur trades, like Louis Riel is suggesting in his correspondence, right? He says right off the bat, you know, because Louis Riel was not immune to these questions. I mean, all the questions that we're having today, you and I, Jason, like they were asked to Louis Riel point blank, you know? They were asked, like, what is a Métis? You know, and Louis Riel answers in 1885, a Métis is you know, a person that has ancestry from a Canadian or Scottish father and mothers from different First Nations within the context of the fur trade was one aspect of his response. You know, so this is what we call in terms of Métis ethnicity and Métis culture and branch of the fur trade culture. And make no mistakes, it is a culture. You know, the fur trade was the so-called backbone of the Canadian culture, both its beautiful and ugly aspects. I mean, we have to embrace both, you know, mm-hmm. Like fur trade was spearheading colonialisms in many ways. And we're penetrating land of First Nations and Inuit in many ways that we have to be aware of. And so Métis people were part of that trajectory. And they were also on the receiving hands of colonialisms through that networks. Now, that being said, once we know that, there's more to it, right? I mean, the Métis people is not just a produce of like unions. It's a culture in its own right, you know, that's sprung off, that emerged across the continent. So we did an inquiry about that, trying to accumulate evidence to show that, in fact, there's multiple points of emergence of that Métis culture. Now, from these studies, we went into different regions to make sure that, you know, our data was in line with what we could find further in different regions, be it like in Northwestern Territories, for example, in Manitoba, obviously, but also in Northern Saskatchewan, Northern Alberta, where you have different communities, as well as in Labrador. You know, there are different experiences of Métis cultures, including in Acadia, which is one of the most contested point mm-hmm. in the academy right now. But going back to our region to answer your question, so we did the same for the Outaouais region, right? Which is like included, very much included in the fur trade network of the old Canadien, Scotmans, and it's part of that fur trade empire, so to speak, where the Hudson Bay Company is battling itself with the Northwestern companies, as well as other companies, smaller companies along the way to get the monopoly of furs and the businesses. So the Outaouais section is a region that is connected, obviously, to the creation of Bytown, which is now Ottawa, and the creation of Bytown with its canal that allowed, like, you know, trading with Kingston, for example. And so it's a great center of commerce, Bytown, which the HBC, the Hudson Bay Company, couldn't fully control. So they couldn't fully control that region in terms of all the trading with the Americans. And it was, like we said in French, a plaque tournante, right? A place where a lot of trafficking and a lot of commerce was happening that were not under any, you know, coerced authority, for example, such as the Hudson Bay Company was trying in the fur trade.
Yeah.
So we've studied that region to discover that. And the work of Guillaume Marcotte is pretty powerful in that regard in his master dissertation, which he just did. And he's going to publish a book about this in the next few months. But we discover a population of what they call free men, right? Free men were people hired in the fur trade, but that were independent enough and skilled enough to go on their own and to do like free trading, if you will, a fur trade. And these populations of free traders across Canada, also in the western, obviously, parts of this country, were kind of very important for Métis ethnogenesis, right? The way in which Métis people like emerged, historically speaking, can be attached to these populations of so-called free men. And so we discovered that there's a huge population of free men in the Outaouais section as well, including in part of Quebec, Maniwaki. And so we dig further and further and further into these evidence until we were, also this needs to be mentioned, we were contacted by the Métis community of Maniwaki that were getting themselves involved into a court case, right? And in that court case, they had one member of their community, a trapper, that got in trouble for having a little shack in the bush where he was practicing, you know, traditional harvesting Métis activities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were asked at this point if we could help in order to provide any evidence of the history of their community. So and so we did, like Michel Bouchard, Guillaume Marcotte and I got together with other researchers as well, and we digged the archives for more than 2 years, and in the case of Marcotte, there are more than 10 years of research in the HBC files and letters. And so we gathered all our strength and we created these report in order to show the evidence about this community, including oral traditions, but also letters from priests, letters from so-called Indian agent officials. We found letters from travelers that speaks about the Métis of that regions. And we also found petitions from the Algonquins themselves that that testify of the presence of the Métis people in their region. Because Jason, you know, like, I mean, you have to understand that the Anishinaabe people of the region of Maniwaki were pressured by the Métis and the fallout of the fur trade. At some point, you know, the fur trade didn't work. So, you know, they had issues in the fur trade and it was collapsing and, mm-hmm. and its economy was collapsing. And there were a lot of layoffs. A lot of Métis were traveling back east or in different regions of Canada or the United States in order to survive and get a living, you know. So the same happened in the Outaouais region. So Métis got back there around 1836, 37, 38. And some Métis got back with their wives and with their entourage and tried to create a community next to the Indian reserves, just like their lifestyle. You know, they were used to have this lifestyle all across North America, you know, living in proximity to First Nations, having, you know, close kinship alliances, but also commercial relationship with First Nations. You know, that was part of their cultural traits, so to speak. And so we found the same evidence in the Maniwaki region, where at some point some Métis wanted to get on the reserves, a reserve for the Anishinaabe people. And the Algonquin did at least two petitions that we know of complaining to Ottawa that these French Métis and Scottish Métis needed to get out of their reserve and their politics, you know? So by doing this, these evidence help us to pinpoint that, yes, there were Métis in that region. We know that not only because descendants of these people still identify today as Métis, but see, the problem, Jason, is that we do not believe them. So we do not believe no longer these Métis and their own voices in claiming that they are Métis, or that their Mémère and Pépère told them that they are Métis and they should be proud of being Métis. And the different language used for that, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, if you know Métis community, you know that some of the Métis that I've seen across Saskatchewan, Manitoba, as well as in northern Quebec and all that, I've traveled to these different places. And you know that these people are talking and sometimes, you know, like what I say, like common language. They will say, you know, remember that we have, you know, we're Métis and remember that we have, you know, Indian blood in ourselves and things like that. And it's not always the best language to formulate their identities, like, you know, universities would like it today to be, or the politics of it today. But it is still like so. So we have to be like cognizant of all that history and all of that culture to understand truly, okay, like these guys were also Métis. And these guys lived experiences of their own and shaped the appreciations of their identity in a very specific way. Like, you know, like, for example, in Maniwaki, close to Maniwaki, we have a small community called Lac St. Mary, which is in our book, which the reader will be able to read about and evaluate for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. A small community of Lac St. Mary next to Maniwaki. And this small community was created by François Nau and Elizabeth McPherson, okay? And Elizabeth McPherson, among other Métis, all these people were squatters, okay? Free traders in the fur trade, you know, retired fur traders, Métis or with Métis children, going there in 1830s. So we're not talking about 1650 and others, like, you know, strange allusions like that. We're talking about 1830s. Creating themselves a small community of Métis families getting together. And in that canoe, the first time they came close to that community was George McPherson there. And if you know Métis history, you know that George McPherson is through Métis and was part of negotiations for the Treaty 3, for example, further west. How do we know that? It's because we found the evidence in the HBC correspondence that clearly states that the HBC was nervous with all these newcomers and Métis in the regions, right? They didn't like that. They wanted these Métis to, you know, go away for them not to disrupt the trade even further. But also they didn't like these squatters. They didn't like these Métis, right? And they didn't want these Métis to form communities of their own either, because, you know, they could influence the First Nation hunters into the trade, and they could, like, you know, produce other agitations. It was deemed by colonial authorities in that regard. Mm-hmm. So this is how we went about to study that community. And to give you a plain example of this, you know, the English book, I don't know if you could, like, on your show, show a picture of the front cover of our book at UBC, but there's a lady on this book, you know, like the upper part of the book shows a lady there sitting. And I don't know if you know who is that lady, Jason.
Tell us, who's the lady?
Who is the lady, right? The question is. So I think it's pretty evocative and pretty interesting, because that lady on the cover, her name is Mary Keith Taylor, okay? And Mary is the daughter of James Keith, who is a chief factor of the HBC at Montreal at this point. And her mother, so the mother of Mary on this picture, is Mary Cadotte, you know? So Mary Cadotte is a very powerful Métis line from Sault Ste. Marie, okay? Mm-hmm. So here you have, like, the Métis daughter of James Keat and Mary Cadotte. And listen to this. She married Thomas Taylor, a Métis from Red River, in 1831. And both of them can be found to live at next to Rivière-la-Lièvre here in the Ottawa, with and among other Métis families, some locals, and some others from different parts of Canada getting together. So, I mean, it's pretty obvious that not only there is a Métis community in the Outaouais region in terms of historical evidence, in our opinions, but it's also pretty clear that we can find further evidence that our conceptions of the Métis network across North America is accurate. Right, because you see Red River Métis having further unions with other Métis people across this continent, be it in Sault Ste. Marie, be it in Maniwaki, Quebec, be it in Abitibi Inland, or in different locations.
Mm-hmm.
So if this is true, then what are we doing when we are suggesting that there are only Métis in Red River? You know, it's not to say that obviously there are Métis in Red Rivers. Obviously, there is perhaps even a different culture that have evolved out of Red River, a different political understanding of themselves, a different, you know, way of seeing Métis identity with time, obviously. I have no beef with that. But I would suggest that this is also true for other regions across Canada, and that these people are not simply non-status Indians confused about their identity, or people that didn't know what Métis truly meant. I mean, come on, you know, these people were culturally the same as any other Métis across this continent. Okay, so this is the statement that this book has put it out there with evidence that's spread over 200 years from different sources, showing that these people were recognized collectively and distinctively as Métis. Why we're saying that? Because sometimes many of these quotes, historical quotes, identify the Métis from the Outaouais different from the French Canadian and different from the so-called Indians of these locations. So clearly, a number of actors, including influential priests, such as Father Nedelec, right? And there's also other priests that have testified of the same. Their testimonies clearly makes no conflation or confusion between Métis or half-breed versus French Canadians versus so-called Indians or Anishinaabe or Atikamek of that region. Things were clear enough. Things were so clear that, in fact, we have found evidence of Métis being discriminated against because they were Métis, you know, right in that region, the same way that Métis were often discriminated against in the Western prairies or elsewhere in Canada. So, I mean, what we did in this book is that we took evidence seriously. We created ourselves a grid by which we have criteria to assess, you know, what could be the emergence of a Métis community. And we did this not out of our hat. We did this by reviewing reports that were made by ethnologists and experts studying Métis populations across Canada. So, you know, in the Western prairies and in the eastern parts of Canada, as well as other places, we accumulated all this work and we created ourselves the best possible grid to study Métis from a cultural perspective, right? And after that, we made sure to identify all the shortcomings and all the silly arguments that could be formulated against the Métis in order to warn the readers and also the academic community that, you know, we have to be careful, we have to be easy on impugnating intent and judging Métis identity per different ideologies that are now very popular in our university and elsewhere. So we did that grid and we did a comparative analysis showing how Métis in Ontario, as well as in Red River, could be compared to those Métis we found in the Outaouais region. And well, in terms of cultural material aspects and the oral traditions, I mean, it's the same. It's the same culture. So now, Jason, one of my problems I'm having with all of these findings is obviously begs the question to some folks out there that are rejecting Quebec, you know, along provincial borders that didn't exist back then, and other politics. It begs the question, what are these people talking about? You know, it begs the question, like, if they really knew their culture and kinship, the way in which they say they do, so much so that they allow themselves to discard and to violently negate the history of other Métis across this land. Okay, so to be honest with you, okay, so this is what's happening now. I mean, we have, unfortunately, the leadership, for example, of the Métis National Council talking about a third invasion by Easterners. I mean, you know, Jason, this is pretty serious language, okay?
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm asking, in terms of these evidence, like, what are we talking about? If we're talking about Métis culture, let's be honest and let's be transparent about it. Now, if we're talking about Métis nationalisms, we ought to know that this is a different thing. It's not to say that we are against nationalisms. I mean, you know, there's different forms of nationalisms out there. If you ask Harry Daniels, for example, in one of his book, Métis Leader, among others, right? The great Harry Daniels.
Mm-hmm.
He said that, you know, the Métis were the original Canadians because they were, you know, the new people that was created out of First Nations, Inuit, and Canadians and Scotmans and different ethnicities coming together. Now, if you're asking Louis Riel, when he wrote a letter to his cousin in 1877, because we do read those letters in the context that they should, is also pretty pleased with the fact that Métis is an inviting and inclusive term that will allow all Métis from all different ethnicity to come together as a people. See, Louis Riel was trying to forge this notion of a Métis nation that was inclusive, wide, and strong. Now, we know that politics got in the way, right? I mean, the politics of that surrounds this work, basically since the Constitution.
Yep.
When everybody was fighting with the Native Council of Canada, right, before 1982, everybody was fighting for recognitions and inclusion. Everybody was pledging not to leave anyone behind, you know? And we have evidence in our book that will show you that, that will show you that the Outaouais Métis people and their descendants were present in 1981 and 1982, you know, making representation to the government because their people were being pushed by the forestries and their rights were not recognized and respected. I mean, these people are not out of the woodwork. They've been arguing for a long time about their Métis rights and cultures, but nobody listened to them. Not only Canada doesn't recognize that population at this point, but the Quebec government doesn't do a good job at this either. And Quebec nationalism certainly doesn't help, to be honest.
For sure.
Because it appears that they do not want at this point to recognize further Indigenous people on what they want to be their unified land. So everybody prior to 1982 was like up in arms and fighting together. And then we know that right after that magic word of Métis was put into the Constitution, then a new organization, the Métis National Council, created themselves and started to argue that no, in fact, only them were the real Métis. It started out by saying that they needed to represent the best interest of the Western Métis, right? If you look at the evidence, mm-hmm. And future generation needs to know that, right? Like, I mean, we cannot be fooled into this. And so basically, yes, that's true. Okay. We understand that Western Métis may have different needs and different, you know, for example, like issues with land claim and whatever, and that other Métis across this country may have different stories or different understanding of their politics and culture. That's fine. But then it turned out to be that the argument started to be, we are the only Métis into the land, the real Métis into the land. So our work and this book begs the questions with evidence. It's like, is that true? What is this thing about being the only true Métis across the land?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we know that the story goes that only, you know, the Western Métis acquired the political will or the political identity strong enough to be a real people. And that all the other Métis across the land were not aware of their identity as half-breed or as Métis. Personally, on its face value, I find that this suggestion is bizarre. Okay. Yeah. People are quite aware of being Métis and half-breed, especially when they are discriminated against for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the case being, we are seeing that in Quebec in 1896 in the correspondence of Father Nedelec, when he is asking that the Métis people access the Témiscamingue reserves at that point. And we found this correspondence in Ottawa, and we found there we found also the response from Ottawa saying back to the priest, we do not want the Métis to form any community in this territory. So it seems pretty clear that not only the government in 1896, not in 1650, like other scholars are trying to create a straw man,
mm-hmm.
in 1896, like these Métis people are pushed to the margin and are pushed to be, pushed toward further assimilation.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what the evidence are showing. This is not what Seb Mallette or Bouchard or Marcotte is saying. This is what the evidence are saying. Now we have these scholars coming from, you know, the neo-nationalist corner that will reply to that. No, these people were not true Métis. I mean, people are just confused, you know. They label them Métis. They call them Métis in these letters. But these are not Métis. They are in fact, Algonquin, mixed blood, not aware of themselves. Well, no. Why? Because we have so-called pure Anishinaabe, the way in which they call themselves in the correspondence, saying that they do not want these Métis on their reserves.
Mm-hmm.
And we even further that, we have a new article coming, Jason, that will be published in a few months now. We even found the voting ballots and the different political correspondence about the management of that reserve to show that there were a coup attempted by factions of Métis people to seize the power of the reserve against the Algonquin. So the Algonquin were not wrong in suggesting that this was not right. This was not fair. So we have evidence of all that politics that did oppose groups of Métis people against sometimes colonial authorities, with the Anishinaabe people squeezed in the middle of all of that politics, sometimes in good terms, sometimes in bad terms. These are human beings after all, so they're no angels. But surely we can see that through evidence that there are Métis people identified collectively and distinctively as Métis people. And for crying out loud, there's even families from Red River marrying with the Outaouais Métis, you know? So if you are going on a limb and suggesting that you know who you are and these Métis people surely do not know anything about themselves and Métis culture, then I reply to you, sir, that at least you should know about the Paul family or the Taylor family or the McPherson family or the McGregor families or the the Cadet family. I mean, there are many Métis families that have joined these communities from all over North America, but also including from Red River. So, I mean, this nationalisms that now exclude other Métis, in my opinion, has a very shallow understanding of Métis culture. You know, it's sad. It's sad, truly, because, I mean, there's no need for that. I mean, you can have a Métis nation that would restrict his membership per various criteria. This is fine by me. If they think that's the best way to go forward with this, if a group of people think that's the best way, I have no beef with that. My job is with evidence and with culture and with, establishing Métis ethnogenesis. I have no beef with that culture. Where I will have a problem, however, it's when this politics, this new politics and new nationalisms is used to do historical revisionisms and to suggest that other Métis were lesser, that they were just mixed blood, that they didn't have consciousness, and treating other Métis people across this land as inferior and subject to, you know, language such as race shifter and all of that. That to me, it's the limit where both evidence and common sense call for something else. So to speak.
Well, it's been actually quite amazing the amount of evidence that you've obviously been able to research in doing this book. Can you tell us, do you got any new projects that are coming up?
Well, we do. You know, we have back-to-back. We got this book at UBC coming out. And we've got a new book waiting. It's going to be published in the next few months as well. And this is a co-edited book that we have planned for some time now. And we'll have different chapters from different contributors that are exploring the history and the culture of the Eastern Métis, in particular pieces about the Acadian Métis, for example, which are still under a lot of pressure due to current politics not to exist, right? Basically, the government doesn't recognize their existence. There are First Nations people that are really not happy about these people coming forward for, I would think, for obvious political reasons and statu quo,
mm-hmm.
right? Sure. The same way that we remember that Tony Belcourt was told by First Nations in Ontario that, you know, not to meet with them and that they would come and they would cause trouble in Ontario if Michi were recognized there, you know, that famous story.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the same happened everywhere. The same happened in Quebec. The same happened in the eastern provinces of Canada for the Acadian Métis people. And so we did, you know, further studies, and we're still doing studies in that region to establish, again, the facts and the evidence. And so we have put a book together. It's going to come out shortly in press. I can come back on your show to talk to you a little bit more about it. But essentially, you know, if you want a teaser about that book, I'm going into the case, one of the chapter going into the case of a guy named Maxime Cormier. And I don't know if you remember that story, Jason, but Maxime Cormier and his father are young. He's a young musician playing guitars. He's a you know, an amazing musician and works with his dad to produce music. Mm-hmm. That is in line with his understanding of Métis culture. And the usual suspects and activists came online and discovered that this guy was being nominated by the ECMA, East Coast Music Award, for a prize, right? For a recognition.
Yep.
And so they went after ECMA so hard on social media and in other places that they were successful in ECMA pulling back this award for Maxime Cormier.
Yep.
And so I took that case seriously. Me and another author, that book, took that case very seriously. And we asked the question, well, could Maxime Cormier be an Indigenous person? I mean, what would it take to understand that Maxime Cormier, as well as the community that supports him and that share with him an identity and an understanding of their past and a vision about their future, what would it need from the international perspective, from the Indigenous perspectives, as well as, you know, the rule of law in this country? What would it take for that person to be understood as Indigenous? And what is the past of that person? What are the evidence? Like, I mean, what is the origin of the family of Maxime Cormier?
Mm-hmm.
And so we did all of that in that chapter to show that not only we believe that Maxime Cormier is an Indigenous person and has the right to call himself a Métis, if that is fitting him and his community the best, but that this violence on social media, it has to stop. It's not productive. It's shaming people per their genealogy, laughing people down because they have only one drop of Indian blood, or laughing people down because their genealogy goes back too far, or laughing people down because you say, well, I have Indigenous ancestry and I'm a settler, so therefore you're a settler. No, it means that you had a different experience in your families in the chain of transmission by which you accept to have been assimilated, and other may not have accepted that. That is the difference. you know? Mm-hmm. In the same way, we laugh down people that have so little Indian blood. Well, that, you know, excuse me the term, but that is, that has been the white man mentality since ever. You know, to show that the indigenous people would be like legal blocks or like a liquid of some sort, you know, that you can dilute. No, that's wrong as well. If you take out one of these ancestors, guess what, Jason? You cease to exist.
Exactly.
Okay, it's not just like this block can be replaced anywhere down your tree. And furthermore to that, if you allow me, this is a very, you know, mischaracterization of Métis culture and the struggles that Métis people have across this continent. Why? Because Métis culture and its transmission and the way in which we may experience it is not reducible to genealogy alone. The genealogy comes with the pressure to identify yourself and to be objective about your ancestry. Mm-hmm. There, this is why people go back to genealogy. You know why? You know why, Jason, people go back to their genealogy? Because there's a number of academic out there, as well as activists, pissing on these people, not believing what they say. This is why people get nervous about their genealogy and goes to the wall with their genealogy and try to say, yes, yes, I do exist. See how this is significant for us. But there's no people that I've ever met across this land in my studies that reduce only their Métis experience and identity and heritage to that genealogy alone.
Absolutely.
It's always something more than this. So, you know, to take symptoms of colonial pressure and weaponize it against Métis people, among which we find the most vulnerable populations in Eastern Canada right now. I mean, Jason, we're talking about a population that couldn't even pay my fees as a researcher or the one of my, you know, collaborators. I mean, they didn't have any money to pay in order to have an equal access to justice. Mm-hmm. This is how bad the situation is now, you know? And you have people on the internet saying that, oh, well, these Eastern researchers are only about money. I mean, what are they talking about? And then we have like Métis political figures of importance in this country suggesting that we have an Eastern invasion and that these people are like stealing rights. I mean, for crying out loud, we cannot steal rights. Rights are not like a cookie jar. You know, if I'm exercising my charter rights, for example, am I stealing yours by doing that? Obviously not. You know, the same way that people cannot possibly stole the millions of dollars that the Métis National Council is receiving or any groups. I mean, these monies are reserved to these organizations per special deal they had with the feds. I mean, the situation is that the Eastern Métis right now do not even have money for an office, let alone recognitions. They're left in disarray. Mm-hmm. With increasing regulation that pushed them to become like either Indians or either Canadians or nothing at all. And when we're trying to establish, you know, respectful conversation about this in terms of resurgence, in terms of evidence, in terms of scrutinize what has been written about Métis, the complexity and the beauty of Métis cultures across Canada, and let me say this clearly to you, the specific indigeneity of the Métis people in terms of cumulative experiences, identities, the usage of shifting back in the past in terms of surviving, all of these characteristics, very powerful characteristics, should not be laughed down and weaponized in order to suggest that now there's a third invasion of Métis, that people are stealing rights, that people like this is a call for unrest. This is a call for, you know, for people to get frustrated with issues that sadly, when you look at evidence and what's really going on in terms of research doesn't exist. It simply doesn't exist. I mean, Jason, it's a good recipe for any form of nationalism out there to identify an enemy and like a scapegoat, right? And mm-hmm. you attach to that scapegoat all the bad thing there is in the world, right? So you'll say that these Eastern Métis are fakes and opportunists and, you know, and then you will try to entice First Nations to aid them as well. And then these guys are stealing our rights and our monies. And you will go on shows and you will cry yourself out, you know, and you'll say like, well, these guys are evil doers and they have the worst intent. Let me be straight with that as well. Like, yes, we've seen a number of cases across Canada of people misusing Indigenous heritage, okay? And this in the East as well as in the West or in other places, all right? Mm-hmm. But this is not to suggest that these people are not Indigenous. This is to suggest or that their heritage may not be true or not true. This is to suggest that their behavior is bad. And if you want to target their bad behavior, then let's do that. Let's target bad behaviors. Let's target, for example, people that are abusing Métis in believing that they will gain rights that they will never gain, for example, due to the lack of evidence or, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, making sure that there's no one abusing, like, you know, land claim or anything of that sort due to politics. These behaviors could be criticized in and of themselves. But see, we don't need to attach what we consider bad behaviors with ethnicity. Because if we do that, then we fall into the realms of prejudices and we fall into the realms of like chauvinisms and all the worst thing that most Canadians want nothing to do with. I mean, you know, or like, mm-hmm. so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So this is, so this is where I stand on some of these issues while pursuing that work, right? Which puts us at odd. I mean, you've seen, Jason, like, all the publicities in the media that these accusations of race shifting is getting, you know, the tractions of, you know, having suspicion toward the wrong Indigenous people. And, you know, there's a high degree of anxiety in Canada in regards to authenticity when it comes to Indigenous issues. But we have to realize that the Métis people are not Indigenous in the same way than, for example, First Nations or Inuit with a different history and a different makeup and a different experience of their past, as well as vision for their future are. I mean, I believe through the work that I'm doing, what I'm seeing emerging is that we have different conceptions of what indigeneity could mean. And we have to be respectful and open enough to see those differences and that these are okay as well, right? And so that if Métis people are considering themselves to be Indigenous people, but from a very different place in their history, culture, and in terms of their worldviews, well, this is fine as well. There's room for complexity in 2020. There's room to see that nationalisms can be fine and good if it's used to help your people striving going forward. Now, if other Métis people want to strive on their own, let's say, for example, the Ontario Métis, well, they have the right to do so. Like, see, I don't understand all of this politics right now with the Sikh community in Ontario. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, you know, there, I don't know if you heard about it, but yeah, there has been a political meeting where two scholars were asked to produce on behalf of MMF a report to negate the existence of Sikh Métis community in Ontario and all of their families and all of their history. And when they came, because you have a recording now available online, if you want to put a link, I don't know if you can do that in your show, but you can see that, you know, the Professor O'Toole from the University of Ottawa is admitting point blank that he did no research, no archival, no ethnological research further into these communities. And that basically he's criticizing the report on their face value. And guess what? He's criticizing this report by two main lines. One suggests that we are confused about using the term half-breed versus Métis, which again, you know, let's be clear about this. This is BS. Okay. This, I mean, Louis Riel was using half-breed as well as Métis, depending the language, English or French he was using. Okay. These splitting hair and forward in regards to using half-breed versus Métis, that doesn't cut it. If you want to be a serious scholar, you have to, you know, raise better argument than this and make sure that you're grounding yourself into an ethnological understanding of Métis culture as wide as possible and on comparative aspects. This was not done by these scholars presenting the document that they did at MMF. That's A. And then they go on and they say, well, these are not Métis people because these are not fitting the neo-nationalist understanding that we have of Métis people from Red River. But obviously not. They're not, Jason. I mean, these guys are Ontario Métis with their own history, their own culture, relating back, for example, to the Mika'bé incident, which we speak in our book, okay, in regards to the Sault Ste. Marie treaty negotiations that did fail for the Métis, okay, during the Robinson in 1850.
Yep.
And all the other aspects that did happen in Ontario. I mean, there's a rich history of Métis culture there. And all of this now is being denied. Denied for what, Jason? Denied because the MNC leadership, the Métis National Council leadership, is suggesting that Ontario is opening the door for a third invasion of Eastern Métis. I mean, Hollywood cannot craft a better story than this. I mean,
would make a good movie.
It made a good movie. What invasion? I mean, what money? I mean, what rights? Eastern Métis at this point are deprived of all of the above. You know, and then we are trying to produce evidence to suggest that and show clearly that Métis communities in Western Quebec are connected to Sault Ste. Marie, are even connected by some family kinship to the community of Red River. And further west, and further north, the Pole, for example, in Northwestern Territory. But this is not appreciated at all. No, rather we have scholars now that sadly are taking these political and ideological arguments further down the rabbit hole, and truly, I mean, we can only wish that by the work that we're doing. That we're going to produce a better and more respectful conversation of the diversity of Métis people across Canada. And let me be honest about this. Like, the study we did, like, shows that, you know, the Métis, that there could be a Métis community in Western Quebec, in the Outaouais region, most specifically. But it has to be well understood that Métis culture is a diaspora, that the Métis, like, the Métis peoplehood is in sync with its cultures, and that as such, you know, you don't have to be contained by a community such as a village or settlement or a regional community. You must do and demonstrate so if you want to go for Section 35 rights. This is well understood, but we have to understand from the perspective of Métis people and culture that the network of the fur trades and this the geographic distributions of all Métis across this continent, as well as in the United States, have nothing to do with these limitations per settlements or these limitations per even regional communities. Okay, these are juridical notions tailored to contain Métis rights bearing communities in line with previous jurisprudence, for example, that we find in Vanderbilt. It has nothing to do with the breadth and the vast aspects, as well as the complexity of Métis peoples across this lands in terms of its cultural makeup. I mean, we can have different philosophy, we can have different political entities now representing the Métis, but certainly not in the way in which it is portrayed now in terms of its sole concentration per one point of origin, that being Red River, by which then the only real Métis emanates from. It's not, it's convenient for the government to think that way. It's certainly convenient for some Métis in Red River to think that way. And let me just remind you, Jason, I know I'm speaking a lot, but I guess confinement does that to you, right? When you get confined, you don't speak to a lot of people. I guess I'm in a herd there. But, you know, remember the Pauli trial. Do you remember all the arguments that the Crown put it forward in order to negate the rights of the Pauli family? Do you remember all these arguments? Huh?
Yeah.
Well, let me refresh the memory of our listeners as well as all of ourselves. The Crown attempted to make a few arguments in order to negate the existence of the Pauli families as real Métis people. First of all, the Crown did mock the blood quantum of the Pauli family. It was like, give me a break, you know? These people, have you seen their blood quantum? I mean, they have only one indigenous ancestor, like close to seven generations ago, and they've married with Germans, and they've married with like French Canadians, and they've married with all kinds of people. And there's no endogamic practice, which means like Michi marrying Michi within the Paoli families. And as this was not enough, then they suggested, the Crown suggested, well, Sault Ste. Marie was never a community to begin with. Are you kidding me? Look at that shallow community. And it went under. And all these types of argument in order to negate the existence of Michi rights were formulated into the Paoli trial, the famous Paoli trial. And all of these arguments were not accepted by the Supreme Court in defining the Sault Ste. Marie Métis communities, which has forever changed the landscape of Métis rights in Canada, as we know. And now, see, all of these arguments now, curiously enough, are now taken back and disseminated by the Métis National Council and suggesting that from their political view and suggesting that the Eastern Métis are not real Métis, or that even the Ontario Métis now, their new target, are not real Métis, it appears. Right? So, and the same goes for scholarly work. We have scholarly work now being celebrated in the media that holds the very same rhetoric that the Crown tried to do to negate the Paoli rights to fish and hunt and harvest as Métis people. So it's not, this is not something new, Jason. This is what I'm trying to suggest. Mm-hmm. The negation rhetoric against Métis peoples across this country has been the same forever, as shown by the correspondence of Louis Riel once again. I know some people are being tired of hearing me speak about Louis Riel, especially when I think the evidence are pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. But Louis Riel, you know, admittedly knew what he was speaking about when he spoke about Métis culture. And in his correspondence, you find that Louis Riel is laughed about by other people, saying that, you know, to be sure, you don't have a lot of Indian blood in you, Louis Riel. Mm-hmm. You could pass for white anywhere you would go. So, and in his correspondence in 1885, he rejects that argument, as a Métis leader should, in my opinion. He says, irrespective of the amount of blood that you may have in you, you know, we are asked to be proud of both our mother and father lineage. And in coming to that identity and that understanding, that if you have anything about that heritage in you, being like Métis heritage, right? And claiming yourself to be a Métis, then you are a Métis. Mm-hmm. See, the freedom and the power of that affirmation has nothing to do with the tyranny of self-affirmation. And people are going like, yeah, well, now there's a gazillions of French Canadian that will start claiming to be Métis, and this is not true, and this is false. Like, I mean, what do you know about that?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of French Canadian that wants nothing to do with it and define as Métis, but there's some of them that do recognize their indigenous ancestors and their Métis cultural aspects and heritage, and for them it's important. Mm-hmm. So this is what Louis Riel allows further, right? And so all of these questions in terms of Métis identities, it's not about self-identification alone. We believe we have cultural criteria sturdy enough to assess what is Métis culture and what are Métis communities as well as Métis identities. They belong to pure trade culture. They belong to a specific material culture, being halfway between European practices and First Nations or Inuit practices. You can see them merging together in creating new practices or practices that are applied from both the originating culture, basically. So we have that. We have multiples of languages coming together because the Métis spoke different languages from the different nations that got together. We have this. Then we have their spatial distribution across North America, which pretty much line up the traditional territories of the Métis per their history. And then we have like specific kinship alliances of the First Nations and Europeans and Inuit coming together to create that Métis people. But furthermore than that, we have the codifications of that kinship, because predominantly father are Canadians and Scotsmen and mothers from different First Nations, which has repercussions when this is picked up by colonial authorities to enforce the so-called Indian Act. And the Indian Act did create status Indians out in 876 by excluding especially the Métis.
Yeah.
And we found that again in the correspondence and working in our books, because there is there are a number of Indian agents that are going through different reserves and are seeing that there's Métis there, as well as so-called Indians. And they're asking the government in letters that we found in the archives, how am I going to do that? How am I going to decipher who are the Indians and who are the Métis? They're living together, you know, they're intermarrying. And so the government replies in one of his letters, ask the people who their dad is. If the dad is Canadian or Scottish, you boot them out of the reserve. So basically what happened is that the Métis are facing discrimination due to their kinship structures in line with the fur trade, which then create a shared experience of discrimination. And then and then the boundaries of their identities becomes clearer about this form of discrimination, irrespective of nationalistic grand narrative, a flag or whatever. Métis people are well aware of being Métis, well aware often that they have to hide their heritage in facing mounting racisms in regards to anything indigenous in this country, right? And so the suggestion that Métis identity has to be limited to this notions of nation, you know, alone is not good. It's mm-hmm. It's historical revisionisms.
Absolutely.
I think we have to tap into the cultural understanding of Métis identities and then be respectful of the different nationalistic narratives that emerge from this, including the one from Métis National Council, if they are ready to settle with the fact that other Métis can also exist, just like the, I think, Jason, it's the, I was there during the Daniels trial, you know, in 2008, and I was present when the Métis Settlement General Council from Northern Alberta did their representation in the Supreme Court. And I don't know if you remember, in their intervention, paragraph 30, if my memory serves me correct, you see them plainly state that, and I'm paraphrasing now because I don't have the quote in front of me, but plainly states that they are rejecting and objecting to any attempts by any organization to seize control over all Métis voices across this country. And they are making the suggestion to the court. And no one will say that the Métis settlement are not Métis, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying that the diversity of Métis across this country should be respected in the same way that there's a Métis, that there's a diversity, sorry, about the so-called Indians or Inuit across this country, which are generic terms to understand that word. So I think that we need to divorce fear, neo-nationalist rhetoric, which are fueling on these fears to create artificial boundaries and straw mans and easy target. And we need to further divorce this from claim of racial shifting. It's a really bad idea to investigate Métis culture in terms of race shifting. Okay, because if there is one antidote as a culture to racism, it is the Métis. Okay, I mean, the Métis are culturally anything but the essentialization of a race, you know, that you could shift from one to the next. I mean, they are the merging of contingencies and multiple forms of heritage coming together to create a new people and a sense of community that was forged in very specific historical material.
Exactly.
So, you know, this is what we try to do. And I don't know if I've said too much, but this is what we've tried to address in the first part of our book, Bois Brûlé, for the readers. And then we get further into the evidence of the Grand Outaouais. After that, specific evidence to the Lac St. Mary experience that went down there, always showing the archives. And then we discuss the experience of, for example, the oral traditions of Marie-Louise Riel, you know, and then we further expose the continuity of the Métis in that region, claiming their rights up to 1980s. And, you know, Jason, just to touch up on this, we've made an article recently about the, I don't know if you saw that, passing by the soldier Paddy Riel.
Mm-hmm.
So that work will be translated in our next volume. And this is a very unique story about the soldier of the First World War, expert sniper, a war hero, you know, Patrick Riel. And Patrick Riel, a Métis from Maniwaki, from the same community from Lac Sainte-Marie. In fact, his godfather was François Nau and Elizabeth MacPherson. So really tied to that family. And what's fascinating is that when you take that family and you investigate the records, you see that his father, the father of Patrick Riel, who was sent overseas to fight the German, was written down as a French-Canadian farmer. But, you know, he was living among French Métis communities right next to the River Gatineau. And you know what? He was celebrated in all the war press as a war Métis hero, redeeming the reputation of the Métis nation at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody assumed that he was a relative of Louis Riel. Even himself claimed to be a relative of Louis Riel. And that's a fascinating story because, like a lot of people that did investigate the genealogy of Patrick Riel, did find that it was not related to Louis Riel, except one of the first Riel that came in Quebec a few generations before Louis Riel himself. So they mm-hmm. are connected by family, but not, you know, he's not his uncle, he's not his he's not his cousins or stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of people see, well, see, Mallet is proving us, you know, this is bullshit. Like, I mean, this was not a real Riel, so like, he was not a real Métis. And again, I'm responding, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
This work is so important because it shows that the Métis people of the Outaouais, despite the fact of not being straightforwardly related to Louis Riel, are still claiming kinship with him and are still claiming a common identity as part of the Métis nation. And we're talking about 1918 here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we're talking about First World War period. We're not talking about the 16th century either. And so, and this guy keeps his identity alive so much so that when he's drafted to go to war, the draft, the officer working for the office is telling him, are you a relation to Louis Riel? Because you know that, you know, this regiment has fought your relative. And was trying to shame him down. Do you still hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool, because I'm going to transfer phone right now. Hold on a second. Okay, you hear me well?
Yeah, very good.
Okay, cool. So he was still identified as a Métis and still self-identifying as a Métis. You know, despite the danger of war, the danger of discrimination, he pushed that identity forward, and he became even friend with other Métis soldiers on the front line due to the correspondence that we did find. So there again, an example, a classic example of a Métis person from Quebec, drafted in Ontario, making the ultimate sacrifice as a Métis person. Now, this person, this Patrick Riel, was good enough to be a Métis back in 1918 for everybody included, including, for example, in 1932, a Métis leader from Alberta that wrote a piece about him celebrating. And yet today he's not good enough. He wouldn't be good enough for the Métis people, or some Métis people, and claim that this guy was in fact what? So then you start to realize that this makes no sense, that these stories that are hurting the memory and the history of local Métis people across Canada, this is no good. The same way that it's no good in universities by some professors to claim that there never has been any oral story in Western Quebec in terms of Métis people. And they claim this point blank without blinking on videos in conferences, instructing students about this. And yet, never have met these people, never went to their elders to inquire if there are any oral tradition. Well, that we did in the articles that we did on Marie-Louise Riel that has been published since a while now in English and in French. And then again, you see that there is an oral tradition. We found not only in the families in northern Western Quebec,
met elders in the bush there, in Val des Bois, for example. But we did find evidence in the archives, in the press back in the days, as well as a document made by the families of testifying of that oral traditions of her great-grandmother, okay, connected to the McGregor Métis families from Sault Ste. Marie as well, living in Western Quebec, that claimed that they did protect Louis Riel during his exile and protecting him for time there, as Louis Riel always needed to be in motion, and that this woman, that Métis woman, protected him. And so there are stories that this woman, Marie-Louise Riel, would be related to Louis Riel from a union from the father of Louis Riel that stayed in the dark during his travel for a few of his businesses. But there are no trails to recall that. But this is what we call an oral tradition by me claiming to be among the people of Louis Riel some times ago, and recognizing the press of back in the days of part of the Métis people as well. So to suggest that these people have no oral stories, to suggest that people have no history, to suggest that their veterans as well as their elders have no value and are only race shifters, opportunists, and other things like that, we believe that
this is not the best way forward for any positive conversation to happen. I mean, it may seduce some people in the press, you know, it may seduce a drama seeker, it may seduce some bloggers that wants to entice, you know, hate and excitement on the web about these subjects. It may also entice people that have no cultural understanding of Métis culture
to go by default into a nationalistic narrative simple enough for their identity while attacking the identities of other people. I don't know at this point how to explain this, but certainly we think that by producing evidence and to produce the oral stories of these people, we will get definitely.
Well, and I think that's an excellent point. And I think we're up over the hour here, so I think that's probably an awesome note, Seb, to end our conversation for today. I sure appreciate having you on the show and taking the time for us.
Thank you, Jason. I hope that I didn't let you ask a lot of questions there. I realize.
Well, you have so much great information and great stories to tell, you know, and you could probably go on for a long time.
I mean, you know, that's the problem. I guess that's the problem with people with strong passion. I get up in the morning and I go to bed at night with that passion for sure. And I just want to make sure that everybody and their history and their culture is included into this and respected. I mean, this is my wishes into this, including the people that may understand their history and their culture differently than what I suggest. I mean, coexistence would be best for all of us. I think that this COVID crisis and this situation do highlight to make sure that despite, you know, these accusations and these misunderstanding, we can produce better conversation about this that are more respectful and that are not giving each other like the baddest intent ever and sweepy accusations, and just to realize that, okay, well, what is what exactly, and to make sure that everything seems
perfect. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, Seb, and I really look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Right again, and hopefully all the best for the people in Alberta there and other listeners across this land.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If you want to connect with us on social media, head over to our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter accounts, which can be found by searching for @MetisPodcast, or can email us at metispodcast@gmail.com. Also, we have started a monthly email newsletter, so if you would like to get your email added to the list to keep up with anything new and interesting from us, please make sure to email us and let us know that you want to be on our email list. We hope you all have a fantastic week this week, and until next time, the jig is up.